Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, healthcare, science in the news, questions, answers, debate, dialogue, and also answers to your questions and emails. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program are the opinions of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. And furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, let's take a big deep breath, and I see that we have a caller right away. And today I'm going to break precedent a little bit and go straight to the phone. So let's talk to Marge in Santa Cruz. Hello, Marge, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn. I appreciate your program so much. Thank you. I'm calling about my grandson, who's just about 12, and he gets pain in his chest when he runs, after about 5 minutes. And he saw a physician who prescribed a albuterol inhaler for what he calls exercise-induced bronchospasm.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an EKG, and that was normal. But he doesn't have any wheezing, and he doesn't really, a little shortness of breath, just this pain. And my question for you is, what do you think about oral inhalers for kids that age and any other ideas? And
Sure. Well, if I'm reading this correctly, it's chest pain, not shortness of breath and not coughing. Is that right?
Not coughing and a little bit of shortness of breath, but as he says to me, my grandson, well, all kids get short of breath when they run.
Yes, well,
so a little bit of that, but mostly the pain is the issue.
Okay. And I think that the doctor is trying to, is falling perhaps victim to the expectations of the 10-minute office visit, make sure that you treat the worst disease. And that may be part of what's going on. Exercise-induced asthma or exercise-induced bronchospasm is where the airways narrow as a reaction to just the increased movement of air back and forth across the nerves. It's a hyperreactivity syndrome, and it can be tough to diagnose because you have to be out there with a measurement device when the kid's running around, and that's not exactly easy. Chest pain per se is not a feature of exercise-induced asthma, so you don't want to hang the diagnosis on chest pain, and that's a problem. There are other explanations for chest pain, including heartburn or reflux, which can happen with exercise, and also chest wall pain because, kids are growing and they often get what we like to call growing pains. So there's several other possibilities. At this point, I think the simplest thing to do would be to use the inhaler and see if that shifts the symptoms, because 15 minutes before exercise, if you use the inhaler, and then he runs to the amount that would have given him the chest pain the last time he did it, and he doesn't get chest pain after the inhaler, then, the doctor has made a proper diagnosis on very small amounts of evidence. So a leap of intuition and good points to the doctor. If it doesn't change it, then that would throw the diagnosis into doubt, because albuterol and these bronchodilators in general are very effective for exercise-induced asthma. So I think it would be fine to use it. These are not dangerous medications in children unless the child has any heart disease, which you said he had a normal EKG. So that's actually going pretty far out there to work up chest pain in a child to get an EKG at all. But I think it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. Other possibilities that might be looked into if the inhaler doesn't work would be an echocardiogram. And that's just to check the valves and make sure the valves don't leak. That also will look at the septum, which is the place between the two ventricles of the heart. And very rarely children will develop something called IHSS, which is where the septum expands and enlarges, and that can actually be fatal. And so we always look for those on sports physicals. And every year in the United States, a couple of athletes at the college and high school level die because they had undiagnosed IHSS, and they just drop dead on the field during a game. It's a horrible thing, but short of doing an ultrasound on every single child before clearing them for sports, I think that we have not got a solution to that particular issue.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Yes, I was a little concerned about the safety of the inhaler, but this further information is really helpful.
I wouldn't worry about the safety of the inhaler in an 11-year-old with, let's assume, normal heart for the purposes of that statement. I really wouldn't. And the risk of asthma is so much greater than the risk of using an inhaler, particularly, you know, once before going out and running at physical education hour at school, really disproportionate to worry about the inhaler.
Good. Appreciate that very much. Now, on your podcast, will my daughter be able to read this information? Or
yes, you just have to listen to the podcast, and that'll be up by next Saturday. So you can just have her look on Ask Dr. Dawn.
I certainly will. And my last question is, can one email you questions of disorder?
That's right. You can. You just go to AskDrDawn.com and hit the Contact Us button.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate this today, and thank you so very much for all of your help.
And thank you for the call. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So I wanted to throw out a couple of quick things. One is really throwing out for discussion, because this sort of bugs me. I have two stories here. Well, not two stories, two documents, I should say, related to Levaquin. And one is a letter that Ortho McNeil Janssen was required by the FDA to send out to all doctors. Big red letters in about 20-point type important drug warning. And what it says is that the fluoroquinolones cause tendinitis and can lead to tendon rupture. Okay, I've known that since 1990 when I read the initial package insert on the first fluoroquinolone that was released, which was Cipro. And it's all there in the package insert. But apparently not enough awareness. There have been cases of tendon rupture where people have been crippled because they've lost their Achilles tendon, and that heals very, very slowly. So they want to be sure doctors are aware of it, be careful to warn people about tendinitis. And by the way, if you take a drug like Cipro, or in this case, Levaquin is the drug that's being implicated in this letter, you want to be very alert for tendon pain, that is in the back of the Achilles tendon in particular. And if you start hurting when you're taking one of these fluoroquinolone drugs, you should stop it and switch to a different antibiotic. Okay, that being said, these are life-saving drugs that are very important to have available. They work beautifully for pneumonia, particularly community-acquired pneumonia, which can be from a myriad of different causes. And if you don't pick the right drug, the patient gets to die because you're waiting around for 2 days for a response to your antibiotic. So it's good that we have these drugs. It's also true that they have side effects. And I think that goes hand in hand. Bad disease, strong medicine, potential side effects. But we have zero tolerance of risk in this society, and we need to change that, or at least change our tort system, because there's now a large class action lawsuit for people who had a tendon rupture. And if you had a tendon rupture and you've had Levaquin in the last, I don't know, year before that happened, you can join in this lawsuit and probably get some money. Now, this is a bad idea. Okay, this is just a bad way to handle the problem of complicated medications with complicated side effects and disclosure, which, as far as I'm concerned, the disclosure, this lawsuit's nonsense because the disclosure was adequate. It was there in the package insert. Doctors are supposed to read the package insert. It wasn't hard to find this information. You make a decision based on risk benefit, and you know, someone who's in the hospital with pneumonia who gets Levaquin, who then sues the company because they had a tendon rupture, I think is misusing the tort system. And I'm going to really come down hard on that. By the way, the risk for tendon rupture, if you use this drug, is quoted by the lawsuit as 1 in 800. So that's triple the standard risk. So the risk in walking around population is 1 in 2,500. It goes up, it triples to 1 in 800. That's still a pretty low risk. I think my caution about watching for tendon pain is an important one for everyone to know. But beyond that, we really need to fix this run to the feeding trough frenzy that lawyers get when somebody publishes a warning or puts a warning out there in, you know, black box that wasn't in black box. Our legal system, people see that as an opportunity to make some money. it's not. And I think it has a chilling effect on putting disclosures out there. It certainly has a chilling effect on warning people, because if you had to warn people of everything that could possibly happen when they take a drug, no one would ever take any drugs. And I'm convinced that it's like the vaccine issue. If no one takes any vaccines, more people die from the diseases the vaccines were going to prevent. Well, if everyone is afraid of drugs and not afraid of disease, the same thing's going to happen. And that's just plain foolish. And we're going now to Carlisle in Carmel Valley. Hello, Carlisle, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
My daughter, Kathleen, who's listening now in Santa Cruz, is just graduated from college, and she's thinking of going into a graduate school for nutrition. And I was wondering if you had any ideas on what are the best nutrition schools in the United States with the most intellectually progressive ideas. And sometimes I notice that you cite studies from Europe. And are there schools that are connected in Europe and in the United States where they have kind of sister relationships and they're working on their thought, their nutritional thought? And by the way, we're also organic farmers. So with that background, mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas here?
Well, not specific ideas for schools. I mm-hmm. just don't have that kind of knowledge base in mm-hmm. terms of comparative universities and who has a good program. I would urge her to look at research and see where the research in nutrition is being published from, mm-hmm. Assuming that she wants an intellectually challenging program. Mm-hmm. It's my impression that nutrition degrees vary a lot in terms of their orientation, and some places seem to have more of a, I don't want to demean it in any way to put down trade schools, but they have more of a nuts and bolts, we're creating people who are going to do the work mentality. And that is very different from other programs where they're more looking at doing basic research in nutrition. And as a physician, I am not exposed to the nutrition literature unless I go out and look for it, which I do because of my collaboration in functional medicine. And there is a great deal of excellent research being done. So assuming that you're going for the high-end degree, I would go to Google Scholar or the Journal of Clinical Nutrition and look and see where those papers are coming from, what institutions. I think that would be the best objective way to do it. And now with the internet being what it is, you can easily look up authors and then look up the author's biography and figure out where they're currently affiliated and figure out where the good teachers are going to be or where the good research is going to be. And maybe she isn't interested in research, in which case that wouldn't work. But as far as finding a good institution, that would be probably my first move.
Well, thanks a lot for the information, and that's perfect. So this is a good starting point.
And congratulations on having someone who get through college and be going on to higher and better things.
Thanks a lot.
Have a great day. Let's go to Brooke in Santa Cruz. Hello, Brooke, and welcome to the program.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'm curious about your experience with fish oils and bipolar disorder. I'm curious about the therapeutic levels of fish oil that you need and sort of the balance between EPA and DHA.
Well, this is a very fertile area for research right now.
Right.
And the concept seems to be that the membranes are fluid in people who consume a diet that's high in fish oil, particularly DHA, which is something like 70% of the lipid bilayer in nerve cells. And nerve cells, because they're big, star-shaped cells with extended dendrites, have a lot of surface area. So when the neurotransmitters come along, they actually attach to a receptor on that surface area, and the receptor undergoes a shape change. And that shape change can be rapid and easy and fluid if the membrane is composed of the right kind of lipids, or it can be kind of slow and squeaky, and the membrane effectively resists the conformational change, and so you need more neurotransmitter to get an effect. And obviously, when we're talking about nerves, there are, I believe the number is 70, it might be 90. The average nerve cell has 90 different receptors for 90 different substances. It's just nuts. And we think in terms of one or two neurotransmitters as being all it is, and that's not right. It's a complex orchestration of signal and response. And in bipolar disorder, clearly what's happening from a system standpoint is that you're getting these loops of behavior, kind of like a strange attractor in chaos mathematics. And the person's neurotransmitters and nerves are just engaging in this circular loop that's creating a certain agitation and repetitive behaviors. And when I say behaviors, I'm talking about neural behaviors, not necessarily the same repetitive behavior like a person with OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder might show. But, you know, people get into a rut. And in the case of bipolar, they get into a manic rut. And then they maybe go back to being normal, and then they get into a depressed rut. And it's like the two attractors, the mania and the depression, are fighting each other and pulling the person off true continually in one direction or another. So the idea is that if you put enough DHA in there, that the natural ballast of the system works better, and these neurotransmitters that are supposed to stabilize things can be more effective. And there's anecdotal data. I'm really not aware that anyone has done prospective placebo studies on fish oil. If anybody knows of such a reference, please send it to me, because I would love to see that level of data. But
I mean, I'm looking on PubMed.
Yeah, prospective placebo studies?
I don't know.
Yeah, the trouble is with this sort of thing, you see the report, it comes out, it's just keywords, and then you have to go in, get the actual methods and not the abstract. A lot of times you can't tell how it was done from the abstract.
Right.
And nowadays, unfortunately, I will say this is becoming a barrier to doing research online, is that companies have figured out they can make money by selling those articles. So a lot of articles are getting bought up by a couple of entities, which then sort of hoard them. And you either have to buy a membership or you have to pay by the article. And many people don't have a workaround for that.
Right.
I have a workaround, but it takes about 3 days to get the article. So,
well, going back to sort of dosage levels on the ADHD, I mean, 500 milligrams, is it 3,000 milligrams? Is it something that you can talk about over the phone?
Well, first of all, when you read the estimates of the amount of dietary lipid that we're getting that is omega-6 versus omega-3,
right,
and what would be perhaps closer to the dietary consumption that humans evolved into. So, you know, the last couple of million years when we were going from Australopithecine to through all of the various stages and ending up as Homo sapiens, we were pretty much hunter-gatherers. And so if you calculate the omega-3 content of a hunter-gatherer diet, it's huge compared to our current one. In terms of how much should we be taking, I usually, if I'm going for brain effects, I usually shoot for at least 2,000 milligrams per day of DHA. And that's in the ballpark with the recommendations. How much is too much? Well, depends on your health status. But if you're not taking blood thinners and you're otherwise without any major medical comorbidities, then too much is when your gums start bleeding when you floss. And below that, there's really no downside in taking omega-3s to very large amounts. We have native peoples like the Inuits whose omega-3 levels are through the roof, and they're fine. You know, it's food. They can use it. It's not a drug. It's a food, and our bodies are well adapted to deal with high amounts of it. In terms of treating bipolar disorder, I wouldn't stop with fish oil. Okay. I think you need to use antioxidants, phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylserine, a low antigen diet. You need to check the person for gluten sensitivity. You need to check them for heavy metals. You need to look for anything else that might be destabilizing the system and try to get all of those things out of the picture, because the drugs work, but they work by just slamming the door shut on a lot of activity. So they're very strong, and people don't like to take them because most people who are bipolar prefer to be mildly bipolar rather than mildly depressed, which is how they feel relative to their quote-unquote ideal state when they're taking the medications.
Right.
So it's a difficult disease to treat because people miss the high from the sort of light bipolar that isn't painful and terribly stressful, but it's just nice, just energized and perky and happy, and they love it, and they don't want to give that up. But what we need to do is find a drug that parks them in that state, but we don't have that.
Yeah, Yeah, you don't. Come on, Dr. Don.
I know. Darn it. We need. I know what we need to do. Let's give more money to Big Pharma until they come up with something. What do you say?
Oh, yeah. No. Now, how about this question? Can I see a nutritionist, rather?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I really think that a nutritionist is critical. I also think that there are a number of really good books in the natural medicine world. A couple of authors, Perlmutter and Amen, A-M-E-N, both have a lot to say about bipolar and about natural management of bipolar using nutraceuticals. And if you're going after that approach with nutraceuticals, it needs to be a broad-based approach that looks at all of the other destabilizing things, which in our society now are pollutants, including heavy metal and industrial pesticides, preservatives, etc., and the idea of dietary influences, which I think can be very huge in some people.
Well, this has been really productive. I appreciate your time, and I think it's been a great discussion, and I hope other people are tuning in and will also talk about this.
All right. Very good. Thank you for the call.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is interesting. This just came out this week. An Australian study was published. It was looking at human papillomavirus vaccination, and they were using what they're calling the quadrivalent HPV, and they started in 2007. So that would be what is called Gardasil in this country. And I don't know if it's the identical vaccine that they're using in Australia. The reference I have here doesn't state that. But in looking at high-grade cervical dysplasia in women, they found a 38% reduction in dysplasia of the cervix in women now compared with 2007 before the vaccine was introduced. So that suggests that we have a functional reduction in high-grade dysplasia, which is exactly what we were hoping for with the vaccine. That's what the preliminary small vaccine studies said would happen. But now we have independent confirmation in a large group that is much more reflective of the general population and their behavior. So as girls go from being pre-sexual to sexually active, if they've been vaccinated, it makes a large difference in terms of whether or not they get cervical dysplasia. And so I just want to throw that out and encourage people with adolescent girls in particular to get them vaccinated. As far as vaccinating boys, well, boys are the vector for the disease. So, if you want to eliminate malaria, go after the mosquitoes. Therefore, I think that vaccinating boys is a great idea, and I encourage that as well. Starting this year, I believe it starts in September, there is a change in the way insurance companies are required to pay for vaccinations. So you want to take a look at that if you haven't already done so, because for some people, the cost may be stopping them. But I believe that vaccines are now exempt from high deductible, and the insurance company does have to cover them. So check out your own individual policy, because, you know, they're always going to look for a loophole on that one. But if it's true, might be good time to get yourself vaccinated, certainly before the election. You know what I mean. And let's go now to Bob in Seaside. Hello, Bob, and welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Don. Thanks again for doing the show year after year. It's much appreciated.
You're welcome.
My question basically is, after cancer therapy, successful, what do I do to try to get my body back to normal?
What kind of cancer and what kind of therapy?
I had first stage tonsil cancer, and I had 33 radiations and 3 chemos, and evidently they zapped it and it's over, and I'm 4 months into recovery and it's looking good, but that much radiation was a lot for my 59-year-old body.
Right.
What do I do basically down the road now?
Okay, down the road, post-radiation, head and neck radiation. So a couple of things that you will have to watch, probably not for about 10 years, but one of them is thyroid cancer, because there's no way they can really shield the thyroid when they're giving you radiation at that area, at the tonsil. I mean, you're going to catch the thyroid in the plume, so to speak. So monitoring for thyroid cancer, considering perhaps an annual ultrasound of the thyroid, but at least making sure that your doctor on your physical palpates your thyroid carefully and you sip water a couple of swallows while the doctor checks your thyroid very consciously looking for that. It's just like if someone comes in and they've got a bad family history for breast cancer, psychologically, even though I try to be very careful in my breast exams, I probably am a little bit more careful in people that I'm worried about. And so you want to get that level of alertness on the doctor's part every year and get your thyroid palpated. Other things are very good attention to oral hygiene, because all of those cells in your mouth that also got irradiated along with the tonsillar cancer may have picked up mutations. And so there is a possibility that you could get a skin cancer in your mouth. So when you go to your dentist for your twice a year cleaning, or maybe three times a year if you've got some gum disease, you want to be sure that they, you know, I have a history of oral cancer, please check me carefully. In most studies where they look at who's good at figuring out oral cancer in terms of spotting it, the people who do the best are the dental hygienists, followed shortly after that by the dentist. The people who do the worst are actually the doctors, the MDs, because they don't look in as many mouths as consciously and for as long. You want to go with the people who have the best expertise on checking whatever organ it is. Now, let's talk about, how should we put this, renovation of your body after all of that radiation. Now, hopefully, you were using a healthy diet, lots of fruits and vegetables, lots of antioxidants during your radiation. I hope that your doctors didn't tell you that you had to live on ice cream and crackers for the whole time. I have had doctors give people that advice, and I think it's really bad advice. You want as much in the way of those healthy antioxidants during therapy, because you really want to be sure that all of your other cells don't get damaged, and it makes a big difference. That being said, it's never too late to start eating a healthy diet. So if you're not already doing so, shooting for 7 servings of fruits and vegetables, making sure that you take a mineral supplement because you're over 50, making sure you're getting adequate amounts of omega-3 fatty acids, which we were talking about earlier in the context of bipolar, for the purposes of someone without heart disease, probably 1,000 milligrams of EPA and DHA would be about right for how much is enough. Other things that are important are just overall physical activity. There's a strong correlation between exercise and cancer. It's an inverse correlation, meaning that regular exercise reduces cancer risks. That's something that you want to really look into carefully. Reduce your cancer risk by taking a half an hour walk every day. Sounds like a plan. Okay, so I think that pretty much covers it. It's basically diet, exercise, and if you'll write me at askdrdawn.com, if you'll send me an email with your email, I have a lecture. Actually, I just happen to have the article right here. So let me just flip through here really quickly and see if there's anything that I can add. So basically, no, I've pretty much covered everything. I was looking to see if there are any other particular nutrients for rebuilding, but most of what I have here on this article doesn't address the post-cancer state. It's all about how to support your body during cancer therapy.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay, have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is an interesting study. I expect that there's maybe somebody out there who hasn't seen the television commercial where they tell you that heartburn causes esophageal cancer and you better take the little purple pill. I'm extracting a little bit on the commercial, but that's the message. And that's a message that gastroenterologists have been sending out loud and clear, citing risks of cancer of up to 15 or 20% of people with Barrett's esophagus, making everybody very, very scared about heartburn. And in fact, maybe it's not such a big deal after all. This study, recently published in Ireland, looked at 8,500 patients in the Northern Ireland Barrett's Esophagus Registry. And for those of you who don't know what Barrett's is, in a person with chronic reflux, where acid and bile go up into the lower esophagus, a certain percentage of people will actually develop metaplasia. In other words, the cells will change into a different kind of cell. They go from being mucus-forming cells to being keratinized cells, just like skin cells. So you can think of this as the equivalent of a callus, if you will. But guess what? When cells transform transformational growth factors are released, and these transformational growth factors, plus the recurrent irritation of the reflux in the first place, have been associated with an increased cancer risk. In this study, they followed 8,500 people. They followed them for 7 years. In that time, 79 patients were diagnosed with esophageal cancer and 36 with high-grade dysplasia. So if you add it all up, it works out to 0.22% incidence of these things a year. And previous studies have come up with numbers like 3% a year. So perhaps the significance of Barrett's esophagus has been greatly exaggerated. The risk of progression is less. Does that mean that we should be less aggressive and maybe not scope people annually? Does it mean that we should think twice about giving everybody with heartburn a proton pump inhibitor? Well, you know my answer on that second one. Another interesting study, this one about language development. This was research looking at more than 100 children who were placed in foster homes. They were, on the average, placed in foster homes at about 22 months. They had control group of children, about 60, who did not get placed in foster homes but remained in institutions, and another 60 children who were just in the neighborhood with their biological families, so they weren't in foster care or institutional care. And basically, they turned up some interesting things. If a child was placed in a foster care setting, by the age of 15 months, they had normal language skills. In contrast, children who were placed in foster care after the age of 2 had significant language delays, as did children who remained in institutional care. And we have research going back to the early 60s to show that an enriched environment is very important. And obviously, one-on-one care with a mothering figure, whether that's a male or a female, is irrelevant, but one-on-one care with a mothering figure is very important for all sorts of emotional and cognitive developments. The interesting thing about this study is just that it gives us an age. So adopted by 15 months, put in foster care by 15 months, that needs to be a priority if we're going to give these children who, for whatever unfortunate circumstances, are not being raised by their biological families, if we want to give them a fair start in life, we have a deadline. And that's the importance of this study. So interesting little, almost geeky story here. This happened in Taiwan, where they have different privacy rules. A group of researchers is suggesting that professionals like doctors can solve medical systems problems by setting up essentially a Facebook page or a Facebook group to discuss the issue. This talks about a emergency room staff in Taiwan who set up a Facebook group to discuss their frustration with the lack of government action on fixing emergency room overcrowding issues. And then they posted a link to their Facebook page on the Taiwanese Minister of Health's Facebook page. And the minister joined the group and got to talking online with the workers about their issues and basically used that commentary to shape ongoing legislation and ministerial attempts to deal with emergency room overcrowding. I was just talking with one of our emergency room physicians last night, literally last night, and I hadn't come across this story yet. And we were talking about our own issues with trying to come up with a way to do discontinuous communication, because it can be very difficult to get two doctors in the same room or even on opposite ends of the same telephone line when you need to. So being able to effectively text the ER or email the ER would be wonderful. But we are running into, in this country, a lot of problems with confidentiality are well-founded and important, and I'm not trying to disregard them. But I also think that we need to not just say, oh, well, we can't do that. I think we need to change the laws or create, let's call them, safe havens so that doctors in this country can make use of these sorts of tools without fear of liability and without fear of large federal fines from whoever it is, HIPAA, whoever's in charge of enforcing privacy, because those fines are major. They're, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars, and they're pretty arbitrary. And if you want to fight it, well, go hire a lawyer and pay him thousands of dollars to fight the fine. Not a good situation, and it essentially causes people to just shut down and not be innovative, and that's a bad idea. In the short run, I'm going to go to a couple of emails. Let's see. I have Amber in Prunedale writes, I just wanted to comment on your information regarding increasing C-section rates in the United States and California. In Monterey County, until last year, there were no hospitals that permitted patients to try VBAC. VBAC is vaginal birth after cesarean. Last year, Natividad Hospital did begin to offer this service. CHOMP and Memorial Hospitals still do not allow women the choice of attempting a VBAC. It seems horribly unfair that we are forced to have the more risky C-section rather than being allowed to try for a vaginal birth. Until unfair practices like this are changed in the United States, we will continue to see high C-sections rates and the complications that ensue. That is an amazing statement, and I would love to hear from people in Monterey County if that is your experience. Have you wanted to have a vaginal birth and been unable to do so because your hospital doesn't allow women to choose the method of their childbirth? If I have validation of that, I'd be very interested in knowing it. That is not the situation in Santa Cruz County, and I was unaware of this problem. So thank you, Amber, for bringing that to my attention. By the way, does anybody have any doubt whatsoever why the hospitals are doing that? Liability. And that, it's sad but true. If you attempt a VBAC and it fails, then you can lose your uterus. You can technically even bleed to death, but more likely what happens is that in the course of labor, the uterus actually ruptures. That will be identified by the fetal monitoring strip. And at that point, the woman is rushed for an emergency C-section, which has much higher complication rates for both the mother and the baby. So scheduling the C-section and doing it in a controlled way lowers the risk, if you want to think of it that way, of the hospital being sued for a VBAC gone wrong. We need to find our way out of doing medicine in a way that won't get us sued as the way that we think about doing medicine. This is nuts. And in this case in particular, women are being unnecessarily endangered. And that is really nuts. Amy in Santa Cruz writes, Hi, Dr. Dawn. In the last 2 years, I've developed itchy lips, which I linked to eating jalapenos. The itchiness lasts for 3 days. My lips also become rough, although this is not visible. I can only feel the roughness with my tongue. This has not been a huge problem. I just avoid jalapenos. Oh, Amy, that's a huge problem. Recently, I have had the same reaction on two occasions, perhaps from eating mangoes. What's going on? And will the list of things I have to avoid keep growing? Well, mangoes and cashews and poison oak actually all share similar lectins, which are surface antigens. And that is why people react to mangoes. The part of the mango that contains the most compound is the inside of the skins. So if people remove the skins before eating the mango, that will generally take care of that problem. If you score the fruit and then peel it back and eat it off the skin, that's a great way to eat a mango, but it definitely subjects you to risk of getting that reaction on your lips. With respect to whether or not you're going to get more foods, I am a little concerned about that. The jalapeno reaction that you're describing with the itchy lips probably is a true allergic reaction or immune reaction rather than just being an irritation. And I think it's distinct from the mango issue. That's a different kind of hypersensitivity. If you're worried about getting more food allergies or food sensitivities or any kind of allergic reaction, or it seems like allergies are cropping up harder and stronger, there are three things I recommend doing. One of which is stress reduction, because if allergies are flaring up, it means that the body thinks there's a stressor, and that stress may be psychological, maybe overwork, maybe sleep deprivation, or it could be an infection. But generally, when the immune system kicks up like that, it's not an infection. It's some other form of stress. So stress reduction is always important, but particularly if you feel like you're getting more allergies, you really need to take a look at your life. Secondly, probiotics, because probiotics, dead or alive, even the broken up bits of probiotics make a difference in how your body processes the allergy signal. So making sure that you're getting adequate amounts of Lactobacillus GG, which is the most studied probiotic. I actually recommend using a mixture of Lactobacillus and Bifidobacterium, at least 3 to 5 species, and in volumes of at least 25 billion once or twice a day for once a day for health and 2 or 3 times a day if you're trying to shift something like this allergy issue. High levels of vitamin D in the blood, and you have to get the blood test, so trying to get the vitamin D at or above 50. Don't get above 75, but between 50 and 75 is a good place to be for immune modulation. And there's tons of data in humans, rats, cell culture, that this is the right level to achieve that. And there's an herb called quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, which down-regulates the TH2, which is the allergic type response that we're talking about here. And using quercetin at 200 to 300 milligrams a day has been shown in prospective studies to modulate allergy symptoms. Is it just blocking symptoms versus actually going to the root source of the problem? I think it's probably going to the root source because it does show TH2 modulation in animals, but we haven't, I think, shown that in humans. We do see symptom relief in humans. I think it's a small leap there to say that we're going after the source. I wanted to talk about this study. One of the most underdiagnosed diseases in the elderly is peripheral artery disease. Many people have poor circulation to their legs and don't even realize it. The people who come in complaining are the exercisers. And when they develop it, they notice because they'll maybe walk half a mile. They've been walking that same half a mile for years. And now suddenly they start to get pain in their legs, usually the butt or the thigh muscles, but it can be the calf, when they walk. And if they sit down and rest, the pain goes away. And then they can walk that same distance again. But it's recurrent. The pain always comes back after a set amount of distance. The best test for peripheral artery disease is simply to take the blood pressure in the arm and then take the blood pressure in the leg. This is called an ankle brachial index, and your blood pressure in your leg should be about 30% greater, or 1.3 times the blood pressure in your arm. If it's less than that, particularly if it's less than the blood pressure in your arm, then you have evidence for peripheral artery disease. Now, what this paper is talking about is that people with peripheral artery disease, by definition, have atherosclerosis. They have hardening of the arteries and basically sludge, plaque, filling up the pipe. And if they've got it there, they've probably got it in their neck, they've probably got it in their brain, and they've probably got it in their heart. So peripheral artery disease is grounds for using a cholesterol-lowering medication. Even if your cholesterol is quote-unquote normal, there's evidence that you can benefit by lowering it further. This is probably largely due to the anti-inflammatory effect of the cholesterol-lowering drugs like statins. It can probably be duplicated with the use of natural medicines. But the fact is, if you have peripheral artery disease, then you should be doing something to prevent strokes and heart attack. And only about 1/3 of the people with peripheral artery disease are actually doing that. So we as physicians are really falling down both on identifying this and on treating it. By the way, the ankle brachial index, easy to do in the doctor's office and reimbursed by Medicare, so the doctor doesn't even have to take a financial hit for doing the right thing. And that is nice. A quick study with a little bit of really good advice here. This study looking at childhood obesity and showing that 1 in 5 preschoolers in the United States are overweight or obese. And it turns out that children are not losing that weight as they get older. It used to be that kids would outgrow their baby fat, but we've done something, I don't know, somebody's done something drastically shifting the natural history of child development as far as fat and obesity is concerned. Maybe it's just too much food. Maybe it's not enough exercise. You know, you've got people who are, oh, it's industrial pollution. Oh, it's the genetically modified foods. Oh, it's the hormones. Oh, it's this. Oh, it's that. And the problem is there's data for all of this, but there's no really good solid conclusions. Bottom line is, we overfeed our children. I found in this article something really useful. A portion size is 1 tablespoon of whatever the food is per year of age. So a portion for a one-year-old is 1 tablespoon. A portion for a two-year-old is 2 tablespoons, and so on. So we're feeding our kids larger portions than we should, and psychologically they're getting adapted to the larger portions, and they're weighing more. So maybe what we need to do is give our kids a tablespoon of rice for each year of age, and then they'll be a little bit hungrier for the vegetables that you're also putting on the plate at a tablespoon per year of age. Ditto for the fruits. And of course, you can just eyeball this, a tablespoon. It's about a ping pong ball, a little under, maybe 3/4 of a ping pong ball, if that helps. And while we're talking about kids, now we have a big amount of food allergies in children in the United States. The latest research says 1 in 13 children, or 8% of the population. That works out to 6 million children in the United States. And this is just a huge number and way, way up from what we've understood previously. Now, this was a study funded by an advocacy group. It was online interviews. It was random telephone dialing. So numbers are not as solid as, say, going into an allergist's office. But if that many people say their kids are sensitive, given how difficult it is to deal with a peanut or a milk allergy, I think it's pretty important. Again, lots of reasons, lots of people suggesting it's the genetically modified food, it's the pesticides, it's the preservatives, it's the this, it's the that. We don't know exactly why this is happening, but it's definitely something that needs to have a lot of research energy thrown at it, because when you see a vector like this in the population, something important is going on. Let's go to Frank in Salinas. Hello, Frank. Welcome.
Good morning. I have a real problem with gas. I have a very sensitive stomach. If I drink cold water, you know, I can feel it in my stomach. And so the doctors had me on 20 milligrams of Prilosec in the morning and 300 milligrams of ranitidine at night. And I don't know if that's causing unbelievable amount of burping and heartburn and gas. Do you have any suggestions?
A couple. First of all, have you had any imaging studies or had an endoscopy where they've looked in your stomach?
And yes, they have looked, and there's a certain amount of what they might call sensitivity showing.
Yeah, okay, so it's red and irritated in there.
Yes.
You do not have a hiatal hernia, correct?
Well, I do have sort of a hiatal hernia, okay. But they don't say if it's real bad or moderate.
Okay, so the first thing that I would consider in a patient, and we're talking about the natural medicine stuff in a second, but honestly, if a person's already on a proton pump inhibitor and already on that kind of a dose of an H2 blocker, which are both things that reduce stomach acid drastically, so when you add the two together, you're really knocking out your stomach acid, and you're still symptomatic. You have the belching, the gas, the burping, and the heartburn. So number one, it's not acid that's making you hurt anymore, because you don't have any acid. So you probably have bile reflux, and bile reflux probably is worse than acid as far as its cancer-causing potential. So this is a bad thing. So in a circumstance like that, major medical management, still problems, I think about maybe doing a Nissen fundoplication, which is where they surgically drop the stomach back below the diaphragm and stitch it down so that it doesn't erupt up through the hole in the diaphragm that the esophagus is supposed to pass through, but not the stomach. You should consider surgery, or at least discuss it with your physician, because you have such a big issue. Second, the fact that you're having all of these symptoms suggests now that you're not emptying properly. So the use of a pro-motility agent would be a very good idea. There's baclofen and there's Reglan, metoclopramide, and I don't remember what baclofen's generic name is. But these are old drugs, read cheap, now available generically, and they cause the stomach to empty forward across the pylorus And the faster your stomach empties, the better off you're going to be as far as your symptoms are concerned.
Prescriptions.
Yes, prescriptions. Now, in terms of natural medicine, a promotility agent that might work for you that is dirt cheap and widely available is vinegar, or you can buy hydrochloric acid pills called betaine hydrochloride. And this is a health food store item. When you take an acid, because you're already inflamed, it may cause you symptoms. So you may not be able to tolerate this right away. But many people have heartburn after meals, and if they take a little extra stomach acid at the time they eat, it's paradoxical, but it reduces the heartburn, probably because it forces the stomach to empty forward, and that is a good thing. Too little acid can give you heartburn as well as too much acid, which is very paradoxical, but quite true. Okay.
Would wine be as good as vinegar?
No. No, unfortunately, alcohol has the property of loosening the lower esophageal sphincter, so it will make heartburn worse.
How much vinegar at meal time?
Try a quarter of a cup.
Okay.
And you could mix it in with water. That's the general thing. Some people say a good eighth of a cup. You could start out with an eighth of a cup and a glass of water and do it, you know, at the start of the meal. See if it's helpful.
Okay.
Okay. The other thing that I want to tell you about is also a health food store item. It's called DGL. Stands for deglycerized licorice. And you want to get the DGL for sure, because regular licorice, if you take a lot of it, can raise your blood pressure.
Is that prescription?
Nope, health food store, okay. DGL. And that is a coating. It's a soothing coating that'll get on all the raw spots and help reduce your symptoms.
Okay.
Okay, so we've got trying the acid, either in the form of vinegar, in the form of hydrochloric acid, using the licorice. There are also on my website, askdrdon.com, some helpful hints for reflux. So I would urge you to take a look at those as well.
Thank you ever so much.
You're very welcome, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. It's been fun, and I hope we've all learned something. So this is Dr. Don saying so long, and stay healthy.